His name was Nathaniel. He was a proud Hebrew man. He had a wife, 4 young children. Nathaniel was a slave. His father was a slave. His grandfather was a slave. His great-grandfather was a slave. Slavery was all he knew. From the time he was a small child, each grueling day was the same. The sun came up, work began, and it continued until the sun went down. And this wasn't just his life. It was life for his wife, for all of his children, even all of his countrymen. At a very early age, they were all required to perform this back-breaking work under the careful eye of their monstrous taskmasters. If he talked to a family member while he should be working, he would expect a crack of a whip on his back. If he fell behind the expected hourly quota, he would be pulled aside for a full-on beating. This is how it had been for generations, there in the shadows of the Great Pyramids under the blazing African sun. Nathaniel's Jewish forefather, Joseph, he had done so much for this nation of Egypt. He had warned them of the coming famine. He had advised them to save up their food in preparation. He'd saved this nation. But Joseph, unfortunately, died a long time ago, and the kinder Pharaoh with him. And now, Nathaniel and his family made mud bricks day after day. First, they would mix the soil and water to create this thick mud. Next, they would cut straw into little pieces, and then they would start the kneading process. For 3 days, Nathaniel and the other slaves would have to knead each mixture of mud with the straw, and then it would ferment, and then they would pour it into the molds to form bricks. And the bricks were used to build palaces for the wealthy, to erect monuments in town, to construct roads, to build paths to the limestone quarries. Each day, Nathaniel was evaluated based on what he produced, how many bricks, nothing more, nothing less. To the Egyptians, you see, his people weren't human. They were machines. Their sole job was to produce more and more bricks. And Pharaoh, he was a hard-nosed production manager for whom production schedules were inexhaustible. We get a glimpse into his brutality to the Hebrew slaves in the book of Exodus. Let's look at these passages in Exodus 5. Why are you taking the people away from their work? Get to your labors. You shall no longer give the people straw to make bricks as before. Let them go and gather straw for themselves. But you shall require of them the same quantity of bricks as they have made previously. Do not diminish it, for they are lazy. Let heavier work be laid on them. Why did you not finish the required quantity of bricks yesterday and today as you did before? You are lazy, lazy. That is why you say, let us go and sacrifice to the Lord. Go now and work, for no straw will be given to you, but you shall deliver the same number of bricks. Pharaoh's demands were merciless on these Jewish slaves. At night, Nathaniel would hug his kids very gingerly, their bodies too sore for a sturdy embrace. Sleep was restless and painful, but each morning, Nathaniel would rise early to pray to Yahweh. How long, O Lord? How long? How long will this go on? It had already gone on for 400 years. How much longer? And then one day, Yahweh answered. Moses, his servant, was chosen to lead the people out of their slavery. The Israelites passed through the Red Sea, and the mighty Pharaoh, the evil Pharaoh and his armies were swallowed up in that sea. And God took his people into the desert and reestablished himself as their leader. And God cared for them, and he led them, and he fed them, and he began the long process of breaking the yoke of slavery off of their backs. And one of the gifts that God gave the Israelites was the Ten Commandments in Exodus 20. 10 guidelines about life with God and about life with each other. And so the first 3 commandments, they have to do with the people's relationship with God. He says, you shall have no other gods before me. Don't worship any man-made images. Don't use my name inappropriately. Those are the first 3. And then the last 6 commandments have to do with our relationship with each other. Honor father and mother. Don't murder. Don't commit adultery. Don't steal from each other. Don't lie about your neighbor. Don't get grabby with each other's stuff. And now, if you're counting along, that's only 9. And there were 10. And so embedded in the middle is commandment number 4. It's the longest commandment. It's the most comprehensive of the 10. And its placement right there in the middle is not by accident. It's like a bridge between a healthy relationship with God in the first 3 and a healthy relationship with our fellow people in the last 6. Commandment number 4 is profound in its prominence, especially when you see it in light of 400 years of slavery under Pharaoh that guys like Nathaniel and the rest of God's people had just endured. And so I want to read you the 4th commandment from Exodus chapter 20, verses 8 through 11. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. And on it you shall not do any work, you or your son or your daughter, your male servant or your female servant or your livestock or the sojourner who is within your gates. For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth and sea and all that is in them, and he rested on the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and made it holy. And so the fourth commandment takes us all the way back to the creation account in Genesis 1. It points us to the very foundation of the law of the Sabbath, which is God himself. And it's interesting to note that the Sabbath is never mentioned from Genesis chapter 1 until the middle of Exodus in chapter 16. It's not mentioned about the flood. It's not mentioned to Abraham or Isaac or Jacob or to Joseph or his brothers who threw him into the pit. Not until after the 400 years of slavery does God give the Sabbath a place of prominence among the Israelites. When he reestablished his relationship, he says, listen, one day a week, you're going to stop making bricks. Why? Because God says it's important for you to know that your worth goes much deeper than what you can produce. You need to stop and realize, God says, that you're my child and that you're brothers and sisters to one another. And once a week, you need to just press pause on the madness and just be. Now, this is radically different from what the Israelites had known. It's radically different, quite frankly, from what we know too. And God suggests that in order to be healthy, you must regularly rest. And so today we're in a series called Relationship Resolutions. And this September that marks the beginning of this new year, we want to put some resolutions in place that will help to improve our lives with family and life with our church family as well. And so in the first 2 weeks, we talked about healthy communication. We talked about healthy emotions. And if you missed either of those, you can catch up with them in the sermon archive at whoisgrace.com or at our Who is Grace app, which is just a fantastic tool. But today we're going to talk about living in a healthy rhythm. You see, God designed our lives to be lived in a certain rhythm, in a combination of work and rest, of hustle and renewal. But our 24/7 culture has demanded that we never slow down. And the demand to produce means that we live our lives on the run, squeezing God in where we can. It means that we live off of other people's spirituality because we don't have the time to cultivate our own. It means that we multitask so much that we ourselves are oblivious to the fact that we're constantly trying to do three things at once and never present at any one place. It means we're always on the way to the next thing. And as a result, few of us ever make the time to develop our own direct relationship with God. And these things are particularly obvious in September, this month. With school and sports and activities and new work schedule and ministry launches, stress is high, anxiety is high, exhaustion is high, and connection with Christ is low. And this is a bad rhythm. And there are some subtle warning signs that your rhythm is off, that something is out of whack. One of those is irritability. It's the, I think, number one sign. This goes back to those runaway emotions that we talked about last week. But small things start causing a disproportionate reaction in you. Your kid forgot a section of homework until just before bedtime, or someone is late for a meeting at work, and your reaction is disproportionate because there's no margin in your life. Another warning sign is a loss of impulse control. Things like overspending, that is, looking for a quick high that fits in a shopping bag. Or overeating, or over-medicating, or over-talking, finding comfort in gossip or sarcasm. There's this loss of impulse control that lets us know that something's off in our rhythm. Another warning sign is escaping. That's just turning to things like alcohol or porn or an illicit relationship, or even escaping into movies or romance novels or TV or video games, endlessly trolling Facebook or Pinterest or Instagram, admiring other people's lives instead of living our own. These are escape mechanisms that should signal to us that something's out of whack. The rhythm of our lives needs an adjustment. And if we fail to pay attention to these warning signs, we could be in for some disastrous consequences. Burnout and exhaustion can leave the people and things that are most precious to us in shambles. I'm sure you all have examples that you can point to from your circle of life, but there have been a couple of reminders in my circle of life over the last few months that have gotten my attention. Some of you heard Perry Noble, the founder and pastor of New Spring Church in South Carolina, one of the largest churches in the country, was fired last month by his elders because he didn't heed the warning signs of running too hard. Pete Wilson, the author and pastor of a church of 7,000 people in Tennessee, just resigned last week due to burnout. These were stark reminders to me that if I don't cultivate a rhythm of replenishment, I'm going to be laying in a ditch alongside the road of ministry somewhere while the church carries on without me. I'm sure we can all think of examples like that that hit close to home for us. Someone in your field, someone close to you who went down in flames because they pushed too hard. And like the Hebrew slaves, sometimes we've beholden ourselves to a system that rewards the exhausting grind of endless production. And into our system of hopeless weariness enters a God who says, enough. Receive the gift of rest. And so our big idea today is this. Sabbath is God's gift of restful rhythm. God's restfulness is both urgent and difficult because our motors are set to run at brick-making speed. Sabbath is this act of rebellion against the pervading values and assumptions of our workaholic society. And not only did God command our rest, but Jesus lived it out during his lifetime. Jesus understood the demands of a crazy schedule. Trust me, his schedule would put yours and mine to shame. Imagine the demands of trying to save the entire world with 12 untrained and uneducated employees. Talk about carrying the load yourself. In fact, at one point in Mark 3, Jesus was pushing so hard that word got back to his mom and his siblings that he was working himself to death. He wasn't even eating, and so Mary did what any good mom would do with her grown son. She showed up at his job site and demanded that he come with her. Come on. He was like, Mom, I'm fine. You worry too much. All right, I'm paraphrasing the scripture. But my point is, he knew what it was like to be busy. He knew what it was like to be under pressure, to have a demanding job with demanding people pressing in on you all the time. And Jesus' solution for his busy schedule was to live in rhythm, to work hard and then rest. And he constantly withdrew by himself, even when it meant saying no to the crowds and at times leaving their needs unmet. And he taught the same to his disciples. In one instance, when they had returned from a busy time of ministry, filled with adrenaline, the rush of accomplishment, he said to his disciples this in Mark 6, 31 and 32. He said, come away by yourselves to a desolate place and rest a while. Now, if you're the Bible marking type, I'd encourage you to mark up this little verse for future reference. It's also in your sermon notes and your bulletin. Notice Jesus commanded and modeled four things as it relates to a restful rhythm. The first, it says, come away. Would you just underline that and write disconnect? Just disconnected. This is just removing yourself somehow from the daily hustle and bustle, unplugging yourself from the barrage of communication and information. Just get away. Next, circle, just to keep them straight, by yourselves and write the word alone. There's something about spending some time by yourself with Jesus. Next, underline quiet place and just write peaceful. The location is very important here. Whether it's your car or your bedroom closet, I don't care. Just get somewhere where it's peaceful for you. And finally, circle, rest a while and write replenishing. And so as he introduces this new pattern of rest and renewal, Jesus is also breaking the pattern of more. He's saying, you don't have to minister more. You don't have to do more. You don't have to sell more, control more. You don't have to know more. You don't have to have your kids in more dance and soccer. You don't have to be younger or more beautiful. You don't have to score more. Come away for a bit and rest. And notice, this isn't an expectation to stop working hard. Jesus accomplished ministry at a breakneck pace, but he was deliberate about his rhythm. And if Jesus had to be deliberate about his rhythm, then so do we. We have to work hard to rest. We must be dedicated to being disciplined. The call of the Sabbath is a call to live in proper rhythm, and it takes great intentionality to pull it off. In fact, there's a passage that I love in Hebrews chapter 4. It says, there remains then a Sabbath rest for the people of God. For anyone who enters God's rest also rests from his own work, just as God did from his. Let us therefore, listen to this, make every effort to enter that rest so that no one will fall by following their example of disobedience. You will have to make every effort to participate in this restful rhythm, but it's worth it. And so let's talk for a second just about Sabbath. What is Sabbath? Well, traditionally, it's a weekly, holy, 24-hour period set aside for rest and restoration. The word Sabbath literally means to cease or to stop. And I want to share three important truths about the Sabbath. The first is this: Sabbath is by, for, and about God. It's more than just a day off. It's a systematic opportunity to connect with God's divinity and to admit our own humanity. And so this rhythm of rest was established by God's own example in creation. But think about it. It's not because God was pooped out, like by the time he got done. He wasn't like, man, all this planet making is really starting to kill my back. No, he's all powerful. He did this rest as an example for us to follow and as a built-in opportunity for us to connect with him and worship him on a regular basis. The Sabbath is about him. But the second truth, the Sabbath is both a gift and a test for us. And so Sabbath rhythm was given to us as a gift. Kevin DeYoung calls it an island of get to in a sea of have to. The commands of God were given not to oppress us, but to set us free. But as is often the case, people have taken this gift and made it into a burden. And so the religious leaders in Jesus' day, they forgot that the Sabbath was a gift. And so they made 39 laws for the Sabbath. God gave them something good. Hey, he says, you know what? Why don't you guys take a day off? And then the religious people come along and say, oh, we need to put together a rule book for this day off. And people are like, really? We need a rule book for a day off? Yes, and we're going to discipline you if you disobey the rules. You need to memorize them and follow them. And people were like, I thought the whole point was supposed to be a day off, and now you've made it into a lot of work. Now I actually have a job description for my day off. You've ruined everything again. I was going to take a nap, but now I've got to figure out whether or not I'm obeying the nap rules for my day off. And so you see, the Sabbath is this gift, and we need to see it that way. But also, God offers us a Sabbath as a test. It's an opportunity for us to trust God's work more than our own. While I'm replenishing my soul, you see, I'm trusting that God will fill in the blanks and make up for the stuff that I wasn't able to produce during my 6 days of work. And one of the things that wars against our rest is our own pride. I'll just say it this way. If you go for weeks or months without taking a day off, you are way too convinced of your own importance. Part of Sabbath is that it's an expression of faith. The third truth is this: Sabbath reminds us where our value comes from. When we Sabbath, it's a time for us to remember that ultimately our worth and value does not come from our lists, from what we do, from how efficiently we make our bricks. It doesn't come from our bottom lines or our P&L reports. It comes from who we are in Christ. And without regular seasons of renewal, the human soul will become frantic and eventually start to wither. And so Sabbath is an opportunity to sit in a chair and say, stuff got broken this week. I accomplished some things, some relationships struggled, I took some hits, and then just to let God heal you and let him encourage you or rebuke you or mend you or break you or whatever he needs to do. But respecting a Sabbath is a full-scale rebellion against our Western culture. Everything in our lives says to hurry on to the next thing. But the Bible says, set aside regular times where you learn what it means to be loved for who you are and not what you do. And here's one more truth for free, okay? You're just a better person when you're rested and grounded. Do you know how much better marriage works when you're rested? Do you know how much more patient you are with your kids when you're rested? Do you know how much more efficient you are at work when you're rested? I mean, the heart of Sabbath is this depth of living. It's for our own good. And so Sabbath is God simply saying, rest, rest. I've got it. Just like I've got the mountains and the seas, just like the sun came up this morning and it's going to set again tonight, just like the ocean tides came in right on schedule, just like the grass is growing and the trees are producing just the right amount of oxygen for the atmosphere. And listen, you're not doing a darn thing to make any of that happen. And in the same way, God says, I've got you. I've got your family. I've got your work situation. I've got it. And so we rest. Now, before I get into some specifics, I can hear some of you objecting. I have like a pastor Spidey sense in my head. Some of you are thinking, yeah, this is all nice for you, Derek. You and your kind, you pastors, you guys who only work one day a week anyway. So of course, life is like one big relaxing siesta for you. But the rest of us, we live in the real world. We have real jobs. We have real demands. I can especially hear you moms of young kids who are you're about to blow your stack. You're either ready to storm out of here or you're in tears already. And you're like, oh, sure, I have a Sabbath every week. If you count the time I pray during my 3.5-minute bath that there's no blood or broken bones by the time I get dried off, that's my Sabbath. Or some of you are LECOM students and you're like, you're lucky I'm even here, Pastor. And I'm doing everything in my power to resist the urge to start studying for my anatomy test on my phone while you're preaching this sermon. I get it, okay? And I promise that we're going to avoid legalism. We're going to give lots of grace. We're going to acknowledge that for some of you, there are going to need to be some baby steps involved to start making something like this happen. But I don't think that just outright disobeying this command is an option for us. And there's no indication in the scriptures that this applies only to clergy. This was God's idea for all of us. And there's a reason that the Sabbath command was the hinge point in the Ten Commandments, bridging the gap between loving God and loving people. It's that important. And so let's talk specifics for a second. The first thing I think you need to decide on is a time frame. Remember, we're going to have to make every effort to live in this kind of rhythm of rest, which means that you have to get it on your calendar. Your calendar plays an absolutely critical role in determining who you are becoming as a person, as a Christ follower, as a family member, as a friend. And so you have to ask the question with your schedule, who do I want to become, not just what do I need to get done? And so when you're creating your weekly calendar, this needs to be a priority. And so decide on a day of the week. And if you're taking a baby step, maybe just a 3-hour block on a certain day. For many of you, Sunday is your best day. For me, that doesn't really work. So Friday is typically my Sabbath. And sometimes if I have an obligation on Friday morning, it'll be noon on Friday to noon on Saturday. I try to get that 24-hour block. Obviously, in the Jewish culture, it's sundown Friday to sundown Saturday. That's their Sabbath. But I don't think the exact day is as important as the regularity of the rhythm. We're avoiding legalism and giving grace, remember? And so for your parents of young families, a good idea that I heard was to work out a kind of a kids swap program. Find a friend with kids who also wants to get more serious about this day of rest. And maybe one Sunday after church, the kids go to their house, and the next weekend, they come to your house. And so every other week now, you're getting this Sabbath rest on Sunday afternoon. If you want to strike while the iron's hot, today would be a particularly good day to ask a friend while everyone's really motivated with this message. So really, the first thing is to decide on a time frame for your Sabbath and put it in your calendar on a recurring loop. Now, to get specific, I want to use a kind of an amalgam of ideas from two friends of mine. One is named Merle Meese. He's a pastor from St. Louis who came and did some coaching with our staff on soul care not too long ago. And another is pastor friend Dan White in Syracuse, who's done some great writing on the subject as well. I know Merle talked about a tradition that he uses with his wife at the beginning of each Sabbath day, that they come together and they light a candle when they wake up. And it just marks the beginning of a day, and it sets a tone for the rest and the restoration to come that day. So I want to give you some practical framework. It's a framework for a great Sabbath. And I want to answer the question, okay, if I were to set aside a day each week, what would I actually do during that day? And so in your notes, you're going to see a little picture frame, and it's a picture of a great Sabbath in the middle. And the four components that make up the frame around the outside are what we're going to talk about. Remember, these aren't legalistic demands. These are ideas how to make your Sabbath great. The first is unplug. To unplug is an act of rebellion against the world. Just simply disconnect. Cease from the work, cease from the noise, cease from the technology, the to-do lists, the problem solving, and unplug. Walt Brueggemann says it this way. He says, on the Sabbath, the practical benefits of technology are set aside, and one tries to stand in the cycle of natural time without manipulation or interference. I love that quote. And so for me, I usually disconnect from all email stuff on Fridays. I will still have a phone in case of emergencies, but try to do no work stuff. My friend Dan, I know, tries to incorporate this discipline of unplugging a little bit each day in addition to his Sabbath. Usually they set aside his family 6 to 7 each night for no phones or iPads or computers. The second component is this. It's to gather. One of the ancient components of Sabbath was that it was a time of communal feasting. Friends and family gathering around the table as an expression of celebration. During my sabbatical last year, I read a book by a Jewish author whose parents were immigrants into the States back in the 1950s. He was just a small boy. But he remembered each week walking home from synagogue in New York City with a group of people, often a different group each week, whom his parents had invited for a meal, a celebration of community and life together on the Sabbath. And embedded into the Sabbath is this idea of community. That because no one is working, that also means no one is competing against each other to produce stuff. And so we're all equal in our rest. And so in addition to resting, Sabbath becomes an occasion for reimagining all of social life away from the coercion, away from the competition of production, and toward a more compassionate solidarity between all people. The Bible says that Jesus came eating and drinking. Have you ever read that verse? This is part of what it means to be made in the image of God. When Jesus ate and drank, he ate and drank with sinners. And this was not a secular act, as the Pharisees thought. It was a sacred act. Communal feasting. Now, I have a friend who has a part of his Sabbath tradition. Every Thursday, he has an open table at his house. His life group gathers, they make up the core. But then they're all welcome to invite anyone they want to invite. And it's encouraged that they invite people who are different than they are in some way, maybe a different religion, a different race, a different socioeconomic status. And they have food and wine together, and each time they have a little sacred moment where they go around the table, they share highs and lows from the week. And he says every single time, God shows up. Every time around that table, there's a tear shed or a celebration that we have together. It's a beautiful thing. I think it would be a beautiful thing for many of you who use Sundays for your Sabbath here at Grace to share more meals together after church. Even make it a goal to meet someone new at church and immediately invite them to lunch that day. Part of a great Sabbath is gathering in community and feasting together. So unplug, gather. The third component is this, to recharge. Remember the beginning of that fourth commandment? It says, remember the Sabbath and keep it what? Holy, holy. And so an intentional part of every great Sabbath is getting lost in the presence of God, worshiping him, entering his holiness. Jesus said, abide in me, remain in me, abide in my love. And the Sabbath is this weekly opportunity to stay connected to Christ and to recharge spiritually. For many of you, attending church is part of that if your Sabbath is on Sunday, which I would obviously encourage. But I would ask, what other ways can you intentionally enter into God's presence on that day? What about making sure that worship music's playing whenever you're in the car? For me, I like to spend a good amount of time on Fridays finding my chair, though it's in a bit of a different way than during the week. During the week, I usually read and study, but on the Sabbath, I like to practice an ancient practice called Lectio Divina. It's a more devotional and personal way to read the Bible. It involves just reading one short passage over and over and over again and then personalizing it and having a conversation with God about it. It's using his word as a living word. I also try to pray through my hopes and hurts. And if I'm on top of my game, I'll do a bit of journaling about that in my Evernote. But Sabbath is such a great time to find your chair, maybe for an extended time, and to get with God and to recharge your spiritual batteries. Observing this weekly Sabbath, it ensures that at the very worst, we're never more than 6 days away from a holy perspective. So unplug, gather, recharge. The fourth component is this, recreate. Sabbath should be a playful space. You know, through the Old Testament, we're told that God delights in us. He delights in his children. That this word, it's this phrase, it's a Hebrew phrase that literally means laughing, knowing. That God has a laughing knowing of us. God enjoys knowing you. God enjoys spending time with you. He enjoys when you experience joy. Do you know how I know that? Because joy is at the heart of God himself. He embodies joy. We seriously underestimate God's capacity for joy. G.K. Chesterton asserts that we will not understand God until we understand this about him, that God is the happiest being in the universe. And so Sabbath should include some recreation. Recreation literally means to recreate or to rebuild or to renew or restore, regenerate something in you. There's a big difference between recreation and amusement. So binge watching a show all day on Netflix might amuse you, but it's not necessarily restoring your soul. It's important to figure out what those things are for you that bring restoration. I heard a saying one time, I found it to be very true in my own life, that those who work with their minds during the week, Sabbath with their hands. And those who work with their hands during the week, Sabbath with their minds. And so I typically work with my mind during the week. And so things like mowing my yard and cutting wood and folding laundry, those things fill me up on my Sabbath. That's like recreation for me. For Kim, who's a builder who works with her hands all week, she likes to read and relax on the deck with some coffee on her Sabbath. But we need to figure out how to recreate in a way that's restorative to our souls. So let me just offer this as a next step as we conclude. We said earlier that Sabbath is God's gift of restful rhythm. And I'm wondering if, as I've been talking today, if the Holy Spirit has been pointing out any areas to you where your rhythm of life or your pace of life is out of whack. Maybe one of the great expressions of faith that you could achieve right now is to receive the gift of rest. The past couple weeks, we've made some resolutions for the new year to work toward healthy communication or to nurture healthy emotions. And today I would ask, what is your very next step? What is the one thing that you can do this week to move toward a healthy rhythm in your life? Well, to bring it to conclusion today, we're going to practice the discipline of slowing right now as we enter in a time of worship and meditation and acknowledging that God is God, even when we're still.